And tonight we're going to talk about consciousness and also the latest in cell research and how it is all tied together. Robert Lanza, our guest, his work, Biocentrism. And we'll talk with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Prometheus sounds like a good movie right down our alley. Dr. Robert Lanza, currently Chief Scientific Officer at Advanced Cell Technology, also a professor at Wake Forest University School of Medicine. He has hundreds of publications and inventions, more than 24 scientific books, among them Principles of Tissue Engineering, Essentials of Stem Cell Biology, recognized as their definitive references in the field. Biocentrism, we'll be talking about tonight as well. Welcome back to Coast, Robert Lanza. Robert, how are you?
Very good. Thank you very much.
Good to have you with us. Looking forward to this. This has a little bit of science and a little bit of just something different about the universe, and I'm fascinated with this. You broach it with stem cell research, and you look at the cosmos. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the bridge. How did you gap the two?
Well, it's all part of an effort to understand life, and not just this or that cell or protein, but how did God make life in the universe to begin with?
A question I wish somebody could answer for me. It's baffling, isn't it?
It is. And, I sometimes think that we're still living in the Middle Ages, as a scientist myself, and I go in the lab and, we play with the Petri dishes, but the big questions completely elude us, and we have no more of an understanding of what's going on than the first thinkers of civilization.
We're going to spend a lot of time talking about the biocentrism, but give us some updates. What's going on in stem cell research? This fascinates me.
Okay, well, The cell known as the embryonic stem cell, which is the body's master cell, was discovered about 13 years ago. And the beginning of this year, we published a paper in The Lancet. This was the very first report of embryonic stem cells being used to treat a patient. And in this case, we treated patients who had macular degeneration, which is the leading cause of blindness in the developed world, as well as a disease known as Stargardt's disease, which is the most common form of macular degeneration in children. So what we showed was, in addition to there being no safety issues, we were able to show actually that the vision of the patient improved after we transplanted those cells, even at the very lowest dosage. This was a safety study. So, for instance, before treatment, the Stargardt's patient could only detect hand movement, but within a week after treatment, she was able to actually start counting fingers. Indeed, before treatment, she couldn't read any letters on the standard visual acuity chart, but within 2 weeks, she could start reading letters. By 1 month, she could read 5 letters. And that doesn't really capture the differences this has made in their lives. So, for instance, the patients report that they can see more color. In fact, one patient started using a computer, can even read her watch. And little things that you and I take for granted can make a huge difference in the quality of a person's life. So, indeed, the dry AMD patient recently went to the mall for the first time. Another patient went to the airport and traveled on her own. Another patient says she can even thread a needle now, which I can't even do with my glasses. So very exciting things going on. That's just in the eye.
It really is. And a lot of scientists now in medical professionals are beginning to harvest stem cells from the individual themselves, aren't they?
Exactly right. And this is known as cellular reprogramming. These are known as induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPS cells. And we have now developed multiple methods to do that. In fact, I published a paper with Dr. Kim at Harvard recently where we can actually now do that without the need of any viruses so that they should be completely safe. And so the hope is to move into the clinic with those very soon.
We had one of our listeners, several listeners, but one specifically, Robert, could barely walk 15 feet without almost passing out.
Mm-hmm.
His heart was so damaged, he was on his last leg.
Mm-hmm.
My guest got him into a trial study of self-harvest stem cells that they mm-hmm. injected into his heart, and he's jogging now.
Yeah.
It's remarkable.
Well, it is, and there's some very remarkable things that you can do with stem cells, as you mentioned, the heart and even for claudication in the leg. So, for instance, we've discovered a type of an ambulance cell with the amazing ability to repair damage in animals. So a single injection of these cells cut the death rate after a heart attack in half, and it completely restored the blood flow to ischemic limbs that might otherwise have to be amputated. So someday we're going to look back and they'll say, you know, can you believe they used to actually cut people's legs off, and then the doctor will give you an injection of cells and save your leg.
Do you see the day, though, Robert, that one day, just as preventative medicine, we will all go in and get a stem cell shot?
Well, yeah, I mean, actually, these ambulance cells I was talking about are very smart, and if you label them and you inject them into the bloodstream, they will go to wherever the damage is. So if you've had damaged heart tissue, for instance, they will go to the heart, or in the eye where you can just look in, you can actually see within 24 to 48 hours that they go in and repair the vascular damage after diabetes. So again, yes, an injection of these cells would be very much like nanoparticles.
Oh,
it really...
God.
A whole new paradigm in medicine.
How close are we to that?
So we're working on that, and we have these cells that are amazing. Just to give you an example, just a couple of months ago, we discovered a new type of super potent stem cell. A single injection of these cells stopped multiple sclerosis dead in the tracks. Animals that were dragging the whole back part of their body that were paralyzed, we gave a single injection on day 6, and those animals were jumping around completely normal. So if you imagine, there are over 100 autoimmune diseases in humans that we might be able to treat with these cells. So for instance, arthritis, lupus, diabetes, even chronic pain in heart, liver disease. We're entering a whole new era of medicine here.
This is dramatic.
It's exciting. It's an exciting time.
And there's no end to it.
Well, actually, these cells, these pluripotent stem cells, as we call them, are the body's master cells, and we can make virtually every cell type in the body, and not only to restore worn out or damaged cells, but using a technique known as tissue engineering, we can actually reconstitute those into more complex tissues and structures in an indeed entire organ, such as a kidney or a heart.
If you injected a cancer cell,
right,
would this kind of cell attack it and wipe it out?
Well, there is actually quite a bit of published data showing that there are some tricks we can do. So, for instance, this new cell type that I had mentioned that we have recently been able to create in large numbers actually has been found, in animals, mm-hmm, to help fight cancer and to prevent it. So there are many ways we might be able to use this technology, and one of them, as you mentioned, is to actually hunt down existing cancer cells to kill them.
Is there a downside with this kind of technology?
Well, of course, we had to go through the FDA to get clinical approval. They're being very, very cautious because, indeed, the very notion that these cells can make every type of cell is of concern, because at that point, if you put them into, say, your brain and you create a tooth or a piece of bone, that's not so good. So they want to be very sure that your cells do what they're supposed to do,
right,
and that they're turned into the cell type that they need to be turned into.
But, so, you know, but also, what would it do to pharmaceutical industries and people? If you start injecting stem cells that find disease and ailments and it fixes it,
mm-hmm,
what do we need drugs for?
Well, the hope is someday you're going to be exactly right there. I mean, even these cells we're even believing now, and there's some data that suggests they can reverse arterial sclerosis. So, yes, I think many of the chronic diseases, many of the ills and worn-out tissues that we have, these cells hopefully one day will repair that damage.
I've got a friend in St. Louis. She's got MS. Great person. Just a superb family. How does she get into programs where she could be a guinea pig, basically?
Well, sadly, these programs take time to go through the clinic. So, for instance, we're talking about macular degeneration. The first clinical trials each involve 12 patients. And we have to go very slowly with only a very few cells to show. For instance, in this study, we were supposed to be just using them to show they're safe, but it turns out that they're actually helping the patients see. So then if we show they're safe, then we'll move on to do more patients, say a few hundred patients, and then eventually a few thousand. And that whole process takes about 5 years before it becomes widely used in the clinic.
So you could comfortably say within 10 years, usage of stem cells, maybe even harvest from within your body, may be just a common everyday thing.
This is true. Actually, it turns out that there is a kind of a stem cell bone marrow transplants that have been used for over 40 years that people use now routinely for cancer and other diseases. So I think that definitely these newer types of stem cells definitely are going to be more widespread than anyone imagined.
You know, we talked about how stem cells can be used to repair heart muscle. What about the arteries that get clogged up? Could stem cells clean those out like Drano?
Well, this is one of the things we're looking into. In fact, we have this type of a cell known as hemangioblast that actually is a cell that existed only in the embryo. It transiently became all of your immune system and blood cells, but also the vasculature. And so by turning these cells into endothelium or these primitive vascular cells, we're actually able to now repair damaged vessels and actually, like you as you're hinting, reverse atherosclerosis. So these cells have the potential to fix many of the problems associated with cardiovascular disease.
Would we ever be in the form where you just pop these as like supplements, pills?
Well, no, actually, these are living cells, so they would need to be injected either, you know, into the tissue or into your blood.
All right, but it would be like a shot.
Exactly.
Interesting. God, that's fascinating. How did you get into this?
Well, it goes way back to when I was a kid. You know, I was very rarely
you love science.
Outside the house, and so I used to go to ponds and catch turtles and flying trees. And
I did the same thing.
Did you really?
Did you ever get little? Did you ever grab them as tadpoles and make them?
Oh yeah. We used to actually get the eggs and put them in our bucket and watch them hatch and turn into tadpoles, and you know. They either didn't make it or we let them go back into the pond.
Yep.
You know, hopefully then they grew up to become frogs.
And you had a chemistry set?
Of course.
Yes. A telescope?
Not one that worked, but I had one.
And you'd go downstairs and you'd tinker all the time.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I mean, I just had a great interest in, you know, nature and how everything went together and why things did what they did.
See, what I did what you did. Except I also loved broadcasting, and I figured this is a way I can, you know, cover these stories that I love,
mm-hmm.
you know, the stories of science and chemistry and things like that. And I went into that direction, and it was just, for me, it was phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I actually started working in my basement. I figured out, actually, at one point how to alter the genetic makeup of white chickens to make them black and then transferring the genes into the pigmented chickens. And, so it was exciting. And, you know, that led me into science. You know, that work, I eventually went off to Harvard Medical School. Actually, that's an interesting story. I was just, a teenager, and I saved up all my dimes and quarters to travel into the greatest place on the planet, Harvard Medical School, and I was going to talk to a doctor about how to do these experiments. And so when I actually got there, the god wouldn't let me in, and I felt like Dorothy in the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
know, and the god said, go away. So I went around the back of the building, and I waited by the dumpster trying to look inconspicuous, and a short, bald guy came up in khaki pants, and I figured, he's the janitor. So I slipped in behind him when he went through the door, and he turns around and goes, well, can I help you, sir? And I said, well, no, I'm looking for a Harvard doctor. I didn't know that this guy was Stephen Kufler, who was the chairman of the Department of Neurobiology and actually founded the department. He had been nominated for the Nobel Prize. Instead, I tell him, oh, I'm good friends with the janitor who lives up the street, and I worked in the kitchen cafeteria. So as we got to talking, you know, I told him I had altered the genetic makeup of chickens. And so he actually introduced me to this guy, Josh Sane, who now runs the Brain Center at Harvard. He was just a grad student at the time. And they invited me back to repeat my experiments. And eventually they were published in Nature, actually, way back in 1974, the year I graduated.
How old were you? What were you, 18?
Yeah, exactly. Well, when I did the experiments, I was a lot younger than that, but that was when I actually published the paper.
Fantastic.
You know, and every now and then the janitor would show up, and I was always excited to see him, and it was only later that they told me who he was, which is a good thing. I probably would have run out had I known.
That's exciting. And where were you born?
I was born in Boston, actually.
Oh, my mother was born in Fitchburg, which is
really? Okay, that's
west of
where I live now, west of the city, yeah.
Yep, and I was, every summer, I'd be out there.
Yeah.
Leominster, Worcester, all over. It was just great.
Oh, Do you ever get back there?
You know, she's there now. She just went to see her family and her sisters. Oh. I've not been back to Boston in about 10 years or so.
Ah, okay.
But gosh, we used to love it. And you remember they used to have these little clam stands like they have McDonald's all over the place?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, those are they still out there or have they gone away?
I mean, you can go up and down the street in the fall, for instance, too. And, you know, there's always the people growing their corn and food from the gardens that they're selling. So, yeah, and there were definitely for clams and fish that you see here and there.
You a Boston Red Sox fan?
Yeah, I live here, so I guess that's
yeah.
definitely cheering for.
Oh, yeah, you get to do that. Well, I'm going to talk with you in a moment about the biocentrism, and you can explain to us what that is, which is, of course, tied into the universe in your theory. And it's going to be fascinating for you to tell me how you made that evolutionary jump from stem cells and science into looking at the cosmos and things like that. But as we just wrap up talking about stem cells as well, are we, and are you, as a scientist and as a doctor, are we being supported by the government to get this stuff done?
Well, I think everyone has heard, you know, that particularly back in the Bush era, that, you know, there was virtually no funding for this advanced stem cell research, these embryonic stem cells. It got caught up in all of the abortion politics. So, you know, all this research has been held up, you know, at least a decade. I started out doing experiments over a decade ago where we injected some of these cells. This was an experiment that was done at Harvard where we injected them into a sheep model of what's called spinal bifida or myelomeningocele. And these animals normally are born paralyzed, and there are kids that are born in wheelchairs. And the first injection we put into those animals, that animal was born walking fine. We didn't have the money. The government didn't fund that. And, you know, I always wonder today how many people are in wheelchairs that are paralyzed because we didn't fund this.
That's right. What about other countries? Are they ahead of us?
Well, for a while, you know, we started losing scientists. They were going to the UK, the Singapore, and elsewhere. Things have started to turn around. There's more money now being used for this. Since Obama got in, they've increased the amount of money being used for this. So I think we're in a little bit of a race, but I think right at the moment we're still ahead, although they are forging ahead over in China and India and elsewhere, sometimes a little more recklessly than we would like here.
Yeah. Do we need embryonic stem cells to do what we need to do? Can we?
Well, We now have that new type of cell where we don't need embryos and where we do not need to destroy embryos. In fact, I published a paper back, you know, the last decade where we actually showed we can now create those cells without destroying the embryo. So we're actually right now in the process of making new master banks for our clinical trials where no embryos were destroyed. So I think between that new technique, which doesn't destroy the embryo versus the iPS cells, I think we're moving ahead where there shouldn't be any controversy.
Absolutely. It should be phenomenal. I don't hear much about cloning anymore, Robert. How come?
Well, actually, this iPS cell technology is one of the main reasons. It turns out that what has happened is that the goal of cloning wasn't to make, you know, 100 copies of, you know, George Zimmerman or Mitt Romney. What we were trying to do was actually make these cells, stem cells that were immune compatible. So say you have heart disease, we can't just make you cells and plunk them into your body because your body will reject them. You need to have your own cells to prevent that.
Right.
And so these new iPS cells, I can just take a blood sample from you or some skin and actually do the same thing that we were wanting to use cloning for. So we don't need cloning anymore to do that.
Okay. That's fascinating. Gosh, what a great science.
Oh, thank
truly
you.
Is. The amazing times ahead.
It is, and I think within our lifetime, you know, one day you'll get in an accident and lose your kidney, and you just go to the doctor, and they'll take some skin cells and grow you up a new kidney.
Yeah, and it's done. Well, they're doing that with ears now and stuff, aren't they?
Exactly. We can now, you know, grow up all types of tissues. Tony Atala, who we've worked with on making tissue engineering and growing up miniature kidneys, has also made bladders that are now being used in patients. So we're now making vessels and ears, and you can... Yeah, virtually, you know, all the tissues of the body, we're now learning to reconstruct. And hopefully, like I said, one day we'll just be able to grow you up whatever organ you need.
If you need a new nose, you just get it done.
Right, right. What you do is you have this synthetic scaffold, and you seed the cells onto it, and then they grow, and eventually, once you transplant that back onto the patient, the synthetic material is reabsorbed, and you're only left with the living tissue.
Boy, that'll change plastic surgery. If you want a nose that looks like someone, they just give you the mold, and you put your own cells on it, and there you go. We're going to be back in a moment. Robert Lanza, our special guest, as we talk about biocentrism next on Coast to Coast AM. Yes, you are with our guest tonight, Robert Lanza, as we talk about biocentrism, and we're going to get right into that, cosmology, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Our guest tonight, Robert Lanza, we're talking about his latest work, biocentrism. Robert, it comes with a little controversy. We'll get into that. Some scientists say, hey, I don't know about this theory, but let's get into it. In your view, what is biocentrism?
Well, it's a new theory of the universe, a completely new view of the world. So we think life is just a big accident, but a long list of experiments suggests completely the opposite. So amazingly, if you add life and consciousness to the equation, you can explain some of the biggest puzzles of science. So for instance, it becomes clear why space and time and even the very properties of matter itself depend on the observer. And biocentrism also explains why all the laws, forces and constants of the universe are exactly fine-tuned for the existence of life. So it turns out that life and consciousness are the keys to truly understanding the nature of the universe.
What came first, the life in the consciousness or the formation of the universe?
See, so that's exactly the dilemma we're in because of the existing paradigm.
Yeah.
What that assumes is that there's this matrix out there called time that's just ticking away. And everyone knows that you know, if you say, okay, what came first, this or that, you're assuming there's just something out there that came first. But everyone knows there's something strange about time and space as well. They're not objects like the shells and pebbles we pick up along the seashore. So if you wave your hand through the air and you take everything away, what's left? And the answer, of course, is nothing. And we think of space as a vast container without walls, but that's wrong. We know from Einstein's relativity theory, for instance, that the distance between objects changes depending on gravity and velocity. So there's no absolute distance between anything and anything else. And the same thing applies for time. You can't put it in a bottle like milk. In fact, quantum theory casts doubt on whether things are truly separated in space and time at all. So, for instance, there are these things known as entangled particles, which act in unison as if they were, even if they were separated by the distance or width of the galaxy, it doesn't matter. They act instantaneously as if there's no space or time between them. So if you look at anything, say the radio you're listening to, you can't really see it through the bones surrounding your brain. Everything you see and experience right now is a whirl of information occurring in your mind. So space and time are simply the tools the mind uses for putting it all together.
All right, let's. This is going to get fun. Let's talk about the chicken and egg for a moment.
Okay.
Because that'll be kind of interesting as we get into this.
Okay.
So you need a chicken. You need a female chicken, and you need a rooster to fertilize the egg, and then a little chicken pops out.
Mm-hmm.
So you need a female chicken to lay that egg.
Mm-hmm.
So in the scheme of things, in order to get that egg, how did we get the female chicken first?
So this is exactly how the human mind is structured to think. We think
logically, right?
Yeah. Well,
chronologically.
Well, we think linear. That time is like an arrow, and you know, you're young and you get old, you die, and you know, and everything ticks along. And then that is because that is how consciousness works. Space and time are the tools, the language of consciousness. But when we start to do all these experiments, we start to figure out, well, wait a minute, there are cause-effect connections, and these experiments are showing them that do not operate using the normal classical way of thinking. So when you think of the chicken and the egg, you're just thinking, so the way I like to think of it is like, you know, you see a squirrel outside and he grabs the acorn and he runs up the tree and doesn't think anything about it. He just opens his eye in the morning and the world is there. And we're very much like that squirrel. We open our eyes and we think we're just here magically and that the universe is here with all the laws, forces, and constants exactly right for us. And just a big accident. And that's the mistake. So when you think of the chicken and the egg, what all human thinking is relational. So you can't have darkness without knowing what brightness is. You can't know, you know, order is probably just the other end of the circle of chaos. So all of these things, the beginning and the end, it's part of a system of logic. So what the mind does is it processes information. It's an information system, very much like the material on your CDs when you watch a movie.
I asked a blind person once, what is red? Mm-hmm. What is blue? What is black? And, you know, it's interesting because they have shaped their own mind, in their own mind, what the colors are.
Exactly.
Yet for us, we've got to see it in order to know it. I mean, if I tell you I've got a red phone on my desk, you know exactly what it looks like.
And you hit the head of the nail right on. Consider the weather outside. You see a blue sky, but the cells in your brain could be easily changed so the sky looks green or purple. In fact, with a little genetic engineering, I could probably make everything that's red vibrate or make a noise or even cause pain or make you want to have sex like some birds do. So we think it's bright outside, but your brain circuits could be changed so it looks dark. You think it's hot and humid, but to a tropical frog, it would probably feel cold and dry. So that logic applies to virtually everything. So bottom line is everything you see out there, the reds, the colors, sound, it requires your consciousness. And again, you can't see those things out there through the bone that's around your brain. This is all the way your mind is processing this. And even blind people, that's an interesting thing there too. I mean, in medical school, I always remember that there were some patients, for instance, that were blind. And if you had a pole in front of them, as they approach it, they would duck and go under it, even though they couldn't see it.
Yeah.
So it's a very complex way the mind works.
Well, there's no doubt that whatever has happened here in the universe is not an accident. I mean, I argue with people day in and day out, those who believe that the universe merely just did all this. It just, everything just clicked. There's too much order to it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, it turns out that the universe has a long list of traits that make it look as though everything was exactly tailored just for us. And some astrophysicists are calling this the Goldilocks universe. In the old nursery tale, Goldilocks enters the home of three bears, and she tries different bowls of porridge. Some are too hot, some are too cold. And every time she tries the beds and the chairs, everything, the third one, is always just right. Well, it turns out that the cosmos is exactly the same. Everything is just right for life, not to this or to that. So you can claim it's all a big accident, but starting from the Big Bang, everything seems to have been just incredibly lucky. So, for instance, it started at the moment of creation. When the Big Bang exploded, if it had been one pot in a million more powerful, the cosmos would have rushed out too fast for stars and worlds to form, result no us. Or if gravity or the gravitational force were decreased by a hair, stars, including the sun, wouldn't have ignited. And there are over 200 parameters like that could have any value at all, but happen to have exactly the right value for us to be here. And it strains reason to think that they're completely random. You tweak any of them and you never existed. So claiming it's all this big, dumb accident is no more helpful than saying God did it.
Bingo. Well, you know, it is something that baffles the mind. I have always said there are no coincidences, that these things happen for a reason, that there's a design here. We'll talk about God a little bit later because I want to get your views on that.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk then. Let's bring in your views of this biocentrism, which basically is, this is your theory, isn't it?
Yes, this is correct.
And have you come under fire from some colleagues?
Yes, as a matter of fact, you have to remember that this is an out-and-out challenge to physics, indeed a whole view of the world. So it's not surprising that some people are going to get defensive, indeed quite nasty about it. And, you know, you have to remember that most of us have had more years of indoctrination in school than monks get at monasteries. And so it's far worse for anyone who has had decades of intensive scientific training. And trying to undo a worldview is almost impossible. It's like trying to get a dog to roll over when you tell it to sit. And, you know, but that being said, I've gotten dozens of emails from people, even professors, chairman of the scientific departments at Johns Hopkins, Columbia, Florida, as well as biologists, and they say, you know, you're right on. So the main problem occurs because biocentrism is a proposal for a paradigm shift. And by definition, a new paradigm always appears to be nonsense from within the established paradigm. But that's what science is all about, to carry out experiments and to figure out what's really going on. But scientists are human beings, too, and they have prejudices and preconceptions just like all of us.
Well, why can't humankind, though, Robert, accept honest debate, whether they agree with you or not, without going crazy, you know, without getting ballistic about it? You know, it's almost like, you know, the global warming people, mm-hmm. and, you know, I happen to believe that Earth is a cycle. It's been warm before. It'll be warm again. Hundreds of thousands of years ago, you know, we had higher carbon dioxide during the dinosaur era. I believe that. That doesn't mean I'm in favor of pollution by any means. I think we need a clean planet. But rather than debate and for people to sit back and go, well, all right, this, you know, you're right. The Earth was much warmer 100,000 years ago, they attack you and they scream at you.
Yeah. Well, people definitely have their own self-interest. So, for instance, if you tell a physicist that his life's work was a joke and that he should be applying for grants because that's a waste of time, he's not going
to
be happy.
No, but, well, I guess there's a way to say his life was a joke without saying it like that, right?
Yeah, that's right. But on the other hand, if the scientific consensus should shift, who gets grants and who doesn't will also shift.
Well, that's true. And it's all about grants, isn't it?
Well, no, that's one part of it. But clearly one of the problems is it's even Einstein, you know, when he came up with relativity, you know, that was cutting edge at the time. But then along comes quantum theory and all the new physicists came along and you know, accepted it. But Einstein didn't. And his famous line, you know, God doesn't play dice. It turns out that it's very hard once you've grown up as an adult and been bombarded with certain ways of thinking to undo it. You know, I don't know who it was that used to say the only way you're going to really change is one funeral at a time. Is that it's the same thing, for instance, for gay marriage. If you look at the polls, all the young people are very much in favor of it. And as you get older and older, you know, us older people are more resistant and the support drops off very dramatically. So I think that's true of any new way of thinking.
Well, that's true. Absolutely. So in 2007, you come up with the biocentric universe theory, mm-hmm. which basically says, you know, I'm going to paraphrase you, that life creates the universe rather than the other way around. Is that pretty accurate?
Correct, yes.
Okay. So we will digest how that is. Give me your thoughts on the Big Bang. What was it?
So the whole thing of the Big Bang and the whole thing of the universe is what's going on. And so I think the whole thing is an enormous oversimplification. And so I think when you think of the Big Bang, you're thinking of one of the formative events in the universe. So, for instance, right now you're talking to me, you're sitting on a chair that's going around, it's on the Earth rotating around the Sun, and that's in the Milky Way going around. And all that, if you go to the extreme, you come to the edge of the known universe. Likewise, if you go back, your body is made of carbon. Carbon is made in exploding supernova stars. And if you take that logic all the way back to its extreme, you come back to a singularity, to the Big Bang. So the Big Bang, as well as the universe, is basically the spatial-temporal logic of consciousness, of you, of the observer. And this is exactly what all the experiments are finding. Einstein showed, you know, that space and time are relative to the observer. We're now finding experiment after experiment that the very properties of matter, its location in space, what it, and its temporal properties, are all relative to the observer. And people say, well, that can't be right. You know, how can what's going on out there be dependent on what you think or what you feel? And so you now have the scientific world fractionated. You got one theory that explains quantum theory, and then another one that's completely almost opposed that explains space and time, and they cannot be reconciled, even with these brilliant people such as Stephen Hawking, who, by the way, is now has a new cosmology, a top-down cosmology, saying that what happens in the present determines the past all the way back to the Big Bang.
I have had such a difficult time comprehending the Big Bang theory. You know, when they say that whatever this is started from a very minute point. I just can't.
Well, it's magic. It's one day, suddenly, out of nowhere, out of nothing, you get, you know, 100 gazillion tons of matter in all the laws of nature out of nowhere from nothing. You know, once upon a time in biology, they had something known as spontaneous generation, and they used to think that mice came from old clothes flies, you know, came from decaying meat.
Yeah.
We learned that it doesn't work like that.
I have an easier time thinking that an object the size of the universe blew up in all these pieces or what's out in the universe right now. I would believe that more than the Big Bang theory.
Yeah, well, again, I think that more and more we're coming to believe that what we think of as the Big Bang is just part of an endless process, that the universe is eternal, whether, you know, it's the big crunch and the big expansion. But I think, again, what we're finding more and more is that the world doesn't go together the way we think it does. You can extrapolate the logic, very much like, you know, when you were in geography class and they had that world globe, and, you know, that was, in theory, what everything is possible on the Earth, but you know perfectly well that, you know, you can't go to Antarctica, I mean, in the most conditions, that is pretty extreme. And so I think the universe is really, again, the exhaustive logic that explains any event that is occurring, which is why virtually everything appears to be observer-determined.
Now, because you're a scientist, I'm sure you've experimented and you've used methods to try to back up your theory. Have you, and what have they been?
Well, I mean, yeah, as a scientist, I've been accumulating pretty much all of the experiments that have ever been done. So there are new ones that I think are pretty dramatic. For instance, one of the most famous ones is known as the two-hole experiment. So when a scientist watches a particle pass through two holes in a barrier, the particle behaves like it should, like a little bullet, and it goes through one hole or the other. Now, the catch is that if you don't watch it, it acts like a wave and can go through both holes at the same time. So how can a particle out there change its behavior depending on whether or not you watch it? And the answer is simple. Reality is a process that involves our consciousness. It's not a thing. There's another famous axiom in science, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. If there was really a world out there with particles just bouncing around, then we should be able to measure all the properties. And it turns out you can't. So, for instance, a particle's exact location and its momentum can't be known at the same time. So why should it matter to a particle of matter what you decide to measure? Again, the answer is simple. The particles aren't just out there. Or more recently, these particles known as entangled particles. How can a particle possibly instantaneously be connected on opposite sides of the universe, of the galaxy? This violates Einstein's relativity. So they behave as if there's no space or time between them. So again, all of this is because space and time are not external objects. They're tools of our mind.
All right. The fact that you have literally turned this upside down from what conventional science and physics has always believed with this thought now. What does that tell you? What does that tell you about just the thought of the scientists and physicists prior to what you came up with?
Well, the funny thing is a great scientist at the turn of the century, the last century, famously said that, you know, all previous generations have lived and died in a world of illusions. And the irony in that comment was that that was before Einstein, radioactivity, before quantum theory. So this is exactly it. If you imagined 100 years ago, and I pointed up to the sky, and there was this little speck of light up there, and I said to you, oh, there's 500 people up there whizzing to China eating peanuts. You'd think I was nuts. And that was just 100 years ago. So that just shows you, how primitive our thinking may be today compared to what's really out there.
You've come up with your thought about if a tree falls in the forest, if there's nobody there, does it make a sound?
Right.
What about this, too?
Well,
if, for example, a tsunami hits an island and kills 300,000 people. But if we never see it, if we never go there in our minds, has it even happened?
Well, I mean, that's a very complex, what I would call intersubjective question. So the answer is yes and no. Of course, there were people who were there and they would talk to people. And so all of those cause and effects have to follow. So you have to follow causality. But when people say, you know, like, for instance, does the tree make a sound when it falls? It's really a question that many people say, well, of course it makes a sound. It's too dumb to even consider thinking about.
Right.
But what you're really doing is taking a stance. You're saying that you believe in an objective, independent reality. And that's the prevailing mindset, the Western view held since biblical times. The little me is of small importance in the universe. But what really happens when a tree falls? So basic science says that sound is created by a disturbance in the air. So when the branches hit the ground, they create these little pulses of air. And what you have are these little air pressure variations, which spread out at 750 miles an hour. So according to that view of science, what occurs even when an eardrum is absent are just little puffs of wind. There's no sound at all attached to them. Now, if a person listens and it vibrates the eardrum, only if it's pulsating between 20 and 20,000 times a second will you get noise.
Now you've brought up something very fascinating. We'll talk about that when we come right back.